Playback on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Dublin Airport's Airport Club. Make travel effortless with lounge access, stress-free parking, fast-track security and exclusive duty-free savings.
Good morning. On Wednesday evening, the aid flotilla to Gaza was infiltrated by Israeli naval forces. As the news was breaking, late debate brought us this.
We've been trying to make contact with some of those on board, but their phones are either off or are going unanswered. Let's have a listen to the last post by Senator Chris Andrews of Sinn Féin on X in the last couple of hours.
There are 12 to 14 Israeli army vessels lined up in front of us, and we should meet them in about an hour, or around an hour. So this is a peaceful, non-violent humanitarian mission to open up a corridor into Gaza to get aid and food and supplies to the residents of Gaza. We would ask that you contact Micheál Martin and Simon Harris and all your TDs to try and get them at this stage to intervene to ensure the safety of Irish citizens on the Samud flotilla. That's about it, and we will probably lose contact shortly, so thanks to everybody for the support, but keep the eyes on Gaza.
Now, just in the last while, the Israeli Foreign Ministry has released a statement saying already several vessels of the flotilla have been safely stopped. That's in the words of the Israeli Foreign Ministry, and their passengers are being transferred to an Israeli port.
And they were joined on the line by activist Caoimhe Butterley, who was on a legal support vessel following the global Samud flotilla.
The last Irish person that I spoke to was Tara, who's on the US vets boat of a few minutes ago. And she was reporting witnessing the vessels in front of her getting water cannoned and having some sort of chemical substance dropped on them before boarding. So I thought the language was quite interesting in the sense of safely boarded. It perhaps makes the whole operation sound a little bit more sanitized than it actually is.
Sure. And I'm looking at the screens that are open on YouTube. You're live streaming some of the CCTV footage. There were as many as four screens open now. There were as many as four screens open until about 5 minutes ago. I can just see one boat being streamed at the moment. Two boats, people with their hands raised aloft and facing outwards on the boat. Can you maybe explain to anyone who's watching what's going on the boats? What is that? Why are they striking that particular attitude? Is it a safety issue?
Most definitely. These missions to Gaza have existed since 2008. Five of those got successfully to Gaza over the last 17 years of a hermetic siege of the Gaza Strip. But a number of those interceptions have been violent in involving lethal force. So all of the participants on the flotilla are trained in non-violent responses, in conflict de-escalation, in really trying to evidence the humanitarian, non-violent nature of this mission. So these images of people with their hands in the air with life jackets on are really an indication, you know, that these are people from over 44 different countries, people from all walks of life, medics, educators, parents, carpenters, artists, etc., but really united in trying to do, unfortunately, what governments have seemed unable to do vis-a-vis ending the siege, ending the genocide, and bringing desperately needed humanitarian aid to people in Gaza.
It is understood that at least 16 Irish citizens on board the flotilla have now been detained. Taoiseach Simon Harris has said that the Irish government has registered its strong condemnation of the actions and demanded consular access to the Irish citizens. Dermot McDouglas is one of the detainees, and his daughter Tracy spoke to Sarah on Thursday's Drive Time, and at that stage she hadn't spoken to her father.
I don't know, like he left from Barcelona, so for over 30 days we've gotten a sunrise and a sunset photo from him, so it's kind of, we've reached the point now of just silence from him. But the Samud flotilla community have been absolutely amazing, with, you know, offering community and support. And there was a family WhatsApp group that is like, this is our source of truth, and we will put updates in here. So don't worry if you see or hear anything on social media, you know, this is the place to go. So until we hear from them, we can't assume anything.
And with more boats in the flotilla continuing towards Gaza, on yesterday's Morning Ireland, Gavin put this to Helen Lawler, a coordinator for the Irish delegation.
But wasn't this outcome, being intercepted, detained, likely deported and not getting aid to Gazans, inevitable? Isn't it inevitable for the next flotilla too?
I don't think it's fair to say it's inevitable, because all that needs to change is either humanity perseveres or governments step up and create this humanitarian aid corridor. The sea is a legal way of travel, and this is through international waters. None of these flotillas are doing anything that's illegal. These are all legal acts. And it's absolutely preposterous to think that one government can control the whole world's reaction to a genocide. And that's what's happening here. So these flotillas will continue over and over and over again until aid gets into Gaza.
From Morning Ireland yesterday. The three candidates in the great amble up the avenue to the Auras were out and about this week. On Monday, they took part in their first television debate on Virgin Media. But even hardcore politicos like Barry Lenehan and Alison O'Connor weren't riveted.
I think the feeling from the various camps this morning that it was an overall nil-all draw between the three, if you will. Maybe Catherine Connolly coming out slightly on top, although one government TD messaged me this morning saying perhaps the real winner last night were the people who went to bed early and didn't watch it at all. So that perhaps might give you an idea of whether this will actually kickstart a campaign which has had a rather lacklustre start, some would feel. Now, the three candidates,
I would watch two flies going up a wall if I thought they were going to have a political discussion. I suspect Barry would, on the promise of a political discussion. And even I'll go around the house listening to podcasts, watching stuff. My teenagers are constantly saying to me, would you put in your AirPods? So my appetite is unquenchable, is what I'm trying to say to you, for politics. And I found it pretty hard going last night. And I got a number of texts from people saying, I'm off to bed. And from that point of view, I found it disappointing. Yes, it was interesting to see the three of them together, you know, just how they would square up to each other. They didn't. I thought that, yes, for me, I would agree with Barry, it was Catherine Connolly who shaded it. But I don't necessarily think that it's a medal that you'd be putting on the mantelpiece, because overall, you know, it wasn't, it was dull enough.
A water cooler moment, but only if you like your water tepid. But the week did bring some headline-grabbing moments, but not always for the right reasons. For Fianna Fáil candidate Jim Gavin, it was a smiling photo of him with the Chief of Staff of the Defence Forces, and then another of him with clapping members of the Irish Army, all posted and then rapidly deleted, because the Defence Forces and its members must be apolitical. Red faces all round. Jim Gavin had this to say.
From the social media post perspective, this is a very active campaign, as you can see. There's a lot going on. Team behind me and beside me are posting things all the time. And every day we review and we have to edit things. And out of abundance of caution in a lot of regard to yesterday, you know, we just tidied it up a little bit. But the primary message, though, is that, you know, from my presidency, it's active. Defence Forces has to be apolitical, absolutely. You know, when that post, as we reviewed that post, absolutely that wasn't appropriate, and we took it down immediately.
And then there was the licensing issue for the drone. Particularly unfortunate given Gavin's role as Chief Operations Officer for the Irish Aviation Authority. Here's Micheál Lehane on the News at One.
I suppose if there was one thing that those looking in at the Jim Gavin campaign would feel certain of, one is that all the rules would be followed and it would be meticulous, and if there was any aviation rules, they certainly would be followed, but they weren't on this occasion. Now, Jim Gavin did, as soon as he found out about this, get the drone pilot to make a report on it, to submit a voluntary report. But no doubt about it, it's a very tricky one indeed for the Fianna Fáil candidate.
And for independent TD Catherine Connolly, it was this staffing decision that had her explaining herself.
Now, listen, we'll start with this report in the journal.ie today.
Yes.
Is it true that you attempted to hire someone who was convicted by the Special Criminal Court of gun crimes and that you wanted that person to fulfil a role in the Oireachtas?
Absolutely. That woman, actually. And it's unfortunate that her name is in the press and that she's been hauled through this. She served her time in prison and she was recommended to me. She was absolutely perfect for the job and I took her on. And it was for 3 days. And over the period of time, from day one, she filled out an application form, explained everything. And just the clearance process took some time. And in the end, she left of her own volition. She was there for almost 6 months, less than 6 months.
You explained she was recommended to you.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, there's an ongoing committee that visit prisons and do work with Republican prisoners and other prisoners. And part of that committee was Claire Daly, Eamon O'Queeve, Maureen O'Sullivan, Thomas Pringle. And when this woman was recommended to me, she had a gold standard in Irish and she had done her time in prison. She'd been a model prisoner. Mm-hmm. And she was in Limerick and then moved to the Dorcas prison in Dublin. And so I checked out, you know, was there anything to be worried about or what were her credentials?
And who recommended her to you?
A number of people, but Eamon O'Queeve in particular. And I've spoken with him and I've asked him, can I use his name? He said, absolutely.
And she was unapologetic in defending this appointment.
And this was a person who had really done everything, realised what they had done was utterly wrong, rehabilitated themselves with the help of the services in the prison, carried out an MA, a PhD, started in prison, since completed, and has gone on to greater things. And, you know, I'm proud of that. I'm actually proud that this person has gone on to greater things. I absolutely regret that she's been dragged into this in such a public way. And it really, really lays bare our hypocrisy. If we believe in rehabilitation.
Catherine Connolly with Clare. And when Fine Gael candidate Heather Humphreys came into studio with Clare, she got a grilling over her time in government and in particular her role in the last year's two referendums on family and care. Referendums which were roundly rejected.
There was a very strong recommendations from a citizens' assembly that the word woman in the home should be taken out of the constitution, and of course that you should have we should recognise other partnerships other than marriage. Mm-hmm. That was the recommendation, and the government tried to bring forward a form of wording that would try to do that. And as I said, we probably didn't put in enough work. But having said all that,
that's some admission, isn't it?
Well, maybe people didn't understand. Maybe we should have put in more groundwork. I'm not. Yeah, that's the truth, because it was confusing. And people made their decision, and I respect the decision of the people. That is democracy.
But when you were asked to be director of elections, did you look at the wording and go, lads, this isn't going to wash? But you still went ahead and you were director of elections.
We all decided this was the best form of wording that could be found at the time, and that's it, Claire. Mm-hmm. So I don't. This presidency is not about a referendum that was held in the past. The decision is made, and as president, that's the business. I would have no role in that. That would be the business of government. We elect a government every 5 years to make these decisions, to bring forward legislation. The role of the president is to check if the legislation...
No, I understand that, but I suppose this is about
within the constitution.
Having this conversation and exploring these matters is just for people to see the whites of your eyes, if you like, so then get to know you and get to know where you're coming from. Heather Humphreys with Clare, ending just some of this week's Auras Roundup. Back in a bit. Welcome back. On Giant Up My Shoulder, chef, food historian and scholar Máirtín McInamara paid tribute to his father, the writer, broadcaster and academic Liam McInamara, a man from whom Máirtín got, among other things, his love of a song.
Songs loom large in my life, and like my father often did, I regularly use them to reinforce my teaching. My students often bet on how far into any class or field trip I will go before breaking into song. Without fully realising it, just like my father Liam, who collected stories about areas in life he was passionate about, I was beginning to do the same. And I was now a magpie searching for food stories and food references anywhere and everywhere. I'm in Hughes's Pub in the Markets area of Dublin, behind the Four Courts on a Sunday afternoon in 1996. It is the final session of Seanós Cuisliffe, a Dublin singing festival that my father was involved in setting up. I hear Gerry O'Reilly sing the Irish Jubilee, which completely enthralls me. This song, about a banquet organised by an Irish-American senator to celebrate his election, has such a wealth of food references and puns that I just have to learn it. Oh, we ate oatmeal till we could hardly stir about. There was ketchup, hurry up, sweet kraut and sauerkraut. Dressed beef and naked beef and beef with all its trousers on. Soda crackers, firecrackers, Cheshire cheese with breeches on. Beefsteaks and mistakes were down upon the bill of fare. Roast ribs, spare ribs and ribs that we couldn't spare. There was reindeer, snow deer, deer me and antelope. And the women had so much melon the men said they can't elope.
What a cracker. You'd want to hear all the verses. And on the history show, Manon, those women. Because while the revolutionaries, the writers, the politicians, the explorers went off to do their thing, their spouses were left behind to hold the fort. And by spouses, we don't mean husbands. Yes, long suffering is often applied to the wives of great men. But a new book seeks to address the balance and looks at the lives of 10 women married to their more famous husbands. Great Irish Wives, Remarkable Lives from History is by Nicola Pierce, and she joined Miles.
Again and again we see behind the great public lives of Irish men lay private worlds held together by women who endured absence and upheaval, but in many cases ensured that their husbands' legacies survived. Although when you're reading it, you will think to yourself, it's a shame that the legacies survived, and they didn't deserve it, and they certainly didn't deserve the women to whom they were married.
Well, let's get some evidence to back that up. We will choose just two wives. He headed off to the Antarctic. She stayed at home.
Emily Shackleton, who married the Antarctic explorer Ernest Shackleton, not that she saw very much of him, he becomes a global hero. He can't sit still.
Yeah.
How does she manage life with him, or more particularly without him, I suppose?
Yeah, the relationship does deteriorate. So I think these men going out to these fantastic achievements just struggle when they come home to settle down. And when he gets back from that endurance trip, there's talks of an actress girlfriend. He's drinking heavily, just cannot settle. He's another man, a lot of them have this in common, useless with money. And he kept thinking he'd get, you know, he'd get a lucky break. And that was his thing of getting involved with the Antarctic, was that, you know, he'd a surefire way to celebrity and money. And it just never happens because he's so hopeless with money. But she stands by him. And when he dies, they're packing up his body. So he goes off on the final trip quest, and he dies out in the Antarctic, and the men are packing him up to bring him home to her. And she makes this generous thing. No, bury him out there. That's where he'd prefer to be.
Yeah, I do wonder about that, though.
You do.
I mean, bury him there, as in, OK, this is where he should be in South Georgia. This is what he loved, being an explorer. And then on the other hand is, I don't bloody want him. I don't want the body back here. I don't want to be going to having to go to his grave, you know, on a weekly basis.
Well, see, within weeks of him dying, she's commissioned an authorised biography of him. So when you read the letters, there's a book of the letters she exchanged with the biographer, and she chose Hugh Robert Cecil. He was well known to the both of them. And like, she was stuck for money. Like, he left her, I was over $1 million in debt. So the biographer actually told her he would, she could have his share of the profits of the book. So she has to start rereading old love letters. I was widowed myself in January. The idea that I would have to, I mean, I've got cards from my husband. I haven't been able to open them up yet. But she totally threw her. This was a project that kept her going in the first few months of her grief. And it's to show him up as a hero.
Yeah, I still have my doubts, but anyway.
And then Constance, who married Oscar Wilde.
Constance Wilde is an amazing person. She's intelligent. She's creative. Yeah. She is a writer. Arguably, she's as good a writer as her husband. But I mean, just, you know, tell me a little bit about her story, about how they came together.
Well, it's interesting. They did genuinely seem to fall in love.
So Oscar was invited into the family home to meet Constance's aunt. That was the dream, that he'd marry the aunt. But as soon as he meets Constance, that's it. They had a lot in common, and you can say that the marriage was a tragedy of itself. But the thing is, Constance picked a man who allowed her to go off and have a career. She was pregnant and on stage. She worked in journalism. She published books. A woman of her standing, had she married a rigid Victorian, would not have been allowed to do any of that. She was as bohemian as he was. She got involved with this whole, she became an activist regarding women's fashion, wanted women taken out of the corsets and the girdles and wear more comfortable clothes, safer clothes. She became a very popular speaker talking about women's fashion and fashion for children. So I think she achieved just as much as he did. But I also think she was very compassionate. She did her best by him.
And even when they weren't together, she was supportive of him.
Still,
she gave him a bit of money to live on and just asked that he just stay away from Bosie, Lord Bosie. And then she writes this letter to her son and says, don't hold it against your father. He's suffered enough. He just suffered because a son hates his father. And that's, you know, just the strength and the love it took for her to make sure the children stayed in touch with him.
And she didn't seem to have any awareness when he was being visited by a lot of eligible bachelors.
She loved meeting his young friends. Yep. She never held it against him and just seemed to be very innocent. And that's what I loved about her too, her innocence. Just tried to do her best by everybody.
And tragically never made it to the age of 40.
No. I have to say her life story makes me cry. It's the one out of the 10 of them I cried over her.
Fascinating from the History Show. And continuing something of a theme with the Darcy.
Are we on the air yet?
We are.
Oh.
We've been on the air for the last 3 minutes.
You forgot to tell me, but anyhow. I did see the red
light.
That keeps
you relaxed. That keeps you relaxed.
Well, I'm actually quite relaxed on the radio. But
good.
Oh, no fear of a panic. As chillaxed as you might expect from a woman from Iceland.
Hrappa. Gunnar's daughter.
Yeah, Gunnar's daughter, yeah.
Yes.
We don't usually go by our last names.
But you are the daughter of
Gunnar. I'm the daughter of Gunnar, yeah. But my brother is the son of Gunnar and my mother has a different last name. There is no family name.
Aha. So your brother is Gunnarsson.
Gunnarsson, yeah. And my father is Gunnar Einarsson. He's the son of his father.
Yes.
We don't want to know who is related to you, you know. It's so insane.
Because it's a small country, small population. What's the population?
Yeah, 370,000. Yeah. 377, yeah.
And Rupert's Gunnar's daughter has just made a documentary marking 50 years since October 24th, 1975, a day when Icelandic women decided to hang up the apron, step away from the desk and just do nothing. Its title, The Day Iceland Stood Still, and it was the brainchild of this feminist collective.
Red Stockings, they actually started working in like 1968, 1970. It was a women's rights group. They wanted to change things for women in Iceland.
And they were responsible for a number of stunts.
Yes, they had great acts. One Christmas, they decided to crucify the housewife. So they brought out a Christmas tree and a doll that looked like a very, very tired housewife and crucified on the Christmas tree because they were tired of, you know, women having to be cleaning up and baking and sewing clothes, you know. And so they were saying, okay, you know, it's enough.
Yeah.
And then they also destroyed
a beauty competition. Yeah.
They decided to bring a cow to the beauty contest. And that effectively killed off interest in beauty contests for about 10 years.
The police were going to arrest them for cruelty to animals.
Yes. Not cruelty to humans, to put them on the same stage, but to the cows.
Yeah, cruelty.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. So the UN declared 1975 International Women's Year.
Yes.
So there was a sort of a platform.
It was a platform. And the Icelandic women that were involved in pushing for women's rights at that time, they felt they had fallen a bit behind. And so they actually started sort of thinking about it during the summertime. And then they decided they were going to have a women's strike.
Ah, strike. But was that word just a little too strident? And we wouldn't want to be strident.
The problem was with women on the right. They said, we can never, never go on strike. That is against our, you know,
beliefs. Communists do that, something like that. It was a terrible word to go on strike. It was something they could not and would never accept.
And then this older, nice little curly-haired woman came up and said, oh, is it strike that you don't like? We could call it a day off.
And women on the right said, yes, why not? That's fine. Okay, a day off.
A day off, you say? Well, who couldn't get behind that one? And they did. About 90% left their jobs and their homes, including Maria.
I think it was the most memorable day in my life, you know. This was so strong. All these women gathered there, no matter where they were in politics or what their profession was or nothing, it didn't matter. We were all there together, and this is just once in a lifetime, I
yes.
think. I think a lot of women that hadn't already been in the Red Sox or paying much attention to women's rights, they learned a lot that day.
Yeah.
And men that had to take their kids to work with them, oh my God, they learned a lot too.
And for Gunnar's daughter, it was a stand that had left a lasting legacy.
And I was even there. I was 11 years old on the square, feeling like, wow, something is going to really change now. You know, yeah. I woke up the next morning. I thought, okay, now everything is fixed. Took a little longer.
Through the eyes of a child.
But, yeah, you know, yeah, it's. Yeah, yeah. I think we have been at the top of this gender index.
For the last 14 years.
Yes. And now we have really topped ourselves because, you know, everybody in high power in Iceland is a woman. We have a female president, prime minister, the bishop is a woman, the three party leaders representing the government. We have 7 women ministers and yeah. out of 12. Yeah, we have achieved something.
Putting it up to the rest of us. And speaking of the sisters, we cannot not mention Tay-Tay's album drop yesterday. John Cook on Liveline spoke to this self-confessed hardcore Swiftie.
You're on your Taylor Swift holidays today, I understand.
I am. I may or may not have taken the day off work for the album release. I can neither confirm nor deny.
It sounds like you did, Aoife. Do they know about this at work or do I need to be careful?
No, they know. They know because I booked it the day after it was announced and I said I'm taking it off for the album. I think they thought I was joking. I was not.
I believe you were up all night, were you?
Well, yes and no. I did go to sleep. I woke up every hour, not intentionally. I had no alarm set. I just kept checking the clock and I was like, okay, no, it's 1 o'clock. No, 2 o'clock. No, you get the idea. Then I woke up after 5 o'clock and I was like, well, I'm awake now. I might as well put it on. Closed my door so I wouldn't disturb my family. Put on my headphones. Got the notebook to do my review and press play on Spotify.
Right, 5 a.m. You were like tossing and turning all night. Are we there yet? Are we there yet? Is she there yet? And, well, getting ready for your reviews, taking this very seriously, putting a whole day's work into it. I've been listening as well there. My daughter got up as well this morning to listen to it too. But I decided I better have a listen there as well before we came on too. It starts with The Fate of Ophelia. Can we have a listen to it? And maybe this is what your first impression was this morning, because this is how it starts. The Life of a Showgirl, The Fate [S2] Yeah. [S1] Of Ophelia is the first track. Let's have a quick listen. Are you dancing, Aoife?
Yes.
I'm kind of bopping along to it. Yeah, and I was embarrassing myself in the office. What's that? We are dancing together, Aoife, to The Life of Ophelia. I couldn't help but dance along. It's good fun, isn't it? It's nice, upbeat, it's catchy. She's in a feel-good mood, is she? First impressions of The Life of a Showgirl, so.
I really enjoyed it. I think it's a very kind of sarcastic album and she's kind of letting people know I can do what I want. I have control over my music. And she's big enough now that she can do what she wants and she will do what she wants.
Almost feel scared, but you'd never cross a Swiftie. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Galoshes out, torches by the door. Our first named storm of the season landed.
Amy sounds so friendly until Storm Amy hits.
Oh yes, because this was the headline from yesterday's 6 o'clock news.
ESB Networks has said 184,000 homes, farms and businesses are without power, mainly in the west and northwest as Storm Amy moves across Ireland. The storm has caused widespread disruption to travel, sporting and other events, with some roads closed due to flooding or fallen trees.
And red, orange and yellow warnings were issued, with Donegal seeming to be particularly hard hit. After five on yesterday's drive time, Claire Brock spoke to Michelle Murphy in Glenswilly, about 10 kilometres outside Letterkenny.
We've been without power here since about 10 to 4. It's actually before the red warning kicked in, our electricity went. It's very, very windy and it was very wet up until about 2 hours ago. The rain eased off, it's coming back again. But I suppose the difference I would see between this storm and our storm I own in January is the speed with which the wind picked up. Because at about 2 o'clock, it wasn't so bad. And then all of a sudden, by 3 o'clock, the gusts were so, so strong. By 4 o'clock, I could see straight across from me here in the field is 2 trees down. Then I looked out into our back garden and I could see a big branch down and I could also hear at least 2 tiles moving on the roof.
So,
luckily we're safe and sound
because,
inside. But
We were so aware of the damage that Storm Eowyn brought last time out, and people lost power for days. You lost power for days, as you're explaining. But I mean, are you seeing it in the same ferocity now? Is that your fear that power could be out for a number of days with this storm?
Yes, well, I actually got a message from a neighbour and you know, they were without power for 6 days last time. We were without power for 4, just in terms of where the line was. I suppose that would be my real concern in terms of, you know, there's still trees down from Storm Eowyn that haven't been moved, and you'd just be concerned in terms of any repairs to the infrastructure, how they'll be impacted. I guess it depends when the crews can get out. I suppose if the numbers keep rising in terms of more people lose power, then there'll be more pressure on them. The only saving grace really will be if not as many people are impacted as Storm Eowyn, then maybe it mightn't take so long. But that would be the big concern.
From drive time yesterday evening, and after the hammering the country got after Storm Eowyn in January, we are all on high alert. But have we learned any lessons from that grim storm? Well, we don't know yet. In fact, the review into the government's response to those storms hasn't been published. On Tuesday's Morning Ireland, Audrey spoke to Peter Thorne, chair of the Adaptation Committee with the Climate Change Advisory Council.
Peter Thorne, we've just got this statement in from the Department of Housing saying that the report is with the Government Task Force on Emergency Planning, and when the department gets it back from them, it will be published ASAP. What do you think of that?
Well, it's good that it's going to be published, but we're well into the next storm season. Some forecasts have the remains of a hurricane in the Atlantic hitting this weekend, particularly the north and west of the country. Are we ready? Probably not.
It's hard to believe, though, that in the year since, almost the year since, that no work has been done on that infrastructure. Are you aware of any work having been done?
Well, there has been bits and pieces of work, as there always is. ESB and others have been definitely undertaking work. Isn't it the scale required and the speed required? Absolutely not.
And not to scare you completely, but Audrey did ask this.
If a storm was to hit us in the next 4 to 6 weeks of similar strength to Eowyn, how would we cope?
We would have undoubtedly learned a number of lessons, but we don't have these local emergency hubs set up and ready to go. So again, we would be scrambling for several days to set up the facilities that people require. We would cope very similarly to Eowyn because we haven't learned the lessons fully yet.
Well, that was Tuesday. But on yesterday's News at One, a counter view from Keith Leonard of the National Directorate for Fire and Emergency Management.
A report published the other day said there were still serious shortcomings in the country's storm preparation. So have any lessons been learnt from Storm Eowyn, which we know caused chaos earlier in the year?
Definitely there has been a lot of lessons identified from Storm Eowyn.
And the minister convened a meeting yesterday of the National Emergency Coordination Group members, and the sectors updated the preparedness pieces that they'd done over the summer to improve the response measures and the resilience. But some of the objectives as well, particularly around critical infrastructure and strengthening critical infrastructure, will be longer term objectives. But even, I know, ESB networks in terms of trees and Irish Water in terms of generation capacity have done a huge amount of work in the last 6 months to improve resilience.
From Friday's News at One. But if you're living in an area prone to flooding, you'll be anxiously watching the rainfall. And with our climate emergency promising ever hotter and wetter weather, the number of houses potentially at risk of flooding is increasing. And certainly extreme coastal flooding is set to rise. Drive Time spoke to Richard Cantwell, Head of Sustainability at Gamma Risk.
We conducted an analysis in 2020 and then again in 2025. And the number of properties that were at risk in 2020 was just under 100,000, about 99,000. Mm-hmm. And 5 years later, we're now up to 104,500. So an increase of about, I think it's 4,700. Against the whole building stock, that's about 4.5% of all properties in the country.
There's a huge human cost to all of this, and that's first and foremost. But the economic cost or the financial cost for people as well. Can you calculate that, Richard?
Yeah, we looked at typical cost of a flood insurance claim and compared that to the total number of properties at risk. And the numbers are extremely high. If you add them all up, it comes up to about 4.5 billion euro of potential insurance claims.
Sorry, billion with a B, is it?
Billion with a B. Now, that obviously means that every single property would get flooded and it wouldn't all happen in one go.
You would hope not. Richard Cantwell on Wednesday's Drive Time. And we will leave that there for now. Just how do you relax if you're a world-class athlete? Bet it's tricky. Fidgety, she'd be just dying to get out and stretch those glutes.
Do you continue training? Do you get to relax? What happens in off time?
No, just literally do nothing.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, literally nothing.
You wouldn't be good at that.
I'm so good at that. You would be so surprised.
What's do nothing for Charlene Maudsley?
Literally nothing, like go for breakfast this morning, like, yeah, just shut off completely. Now I have to walk my dog, so I'm a dog mother, so that's the only form of exercise I'm having right now.
Well, that's European Relay gold medal winners for you. Well, so says Charlene Maudsley, no slouch in the running department, let's face it, but she is taking it handy in between couples weights with her boyfriend, GAA hurler Mikey Breen.
Do you train together, by the way, since you're two athletes?
Honestly, yeah, we do sometimes. In case you're wondering why Mikey has got so fast this year, it's obviously because of me. No, but yeah, we do. Like, he's helped me out in a lot of my sessions this year. And, you know, even on all the hard days after my dad, like, had passed away, he was at the track every day because obviously he was training for the All-Ireland. So he wouldn't do many of my sessions with me at that time, but he'd be there with the video or, you know, whether it was the stopwatch or anything. So the support I had for him was really special as well.
That's therapy, isn't it? For sure.
Mm-hmm.
We saw in the photos from Tokyo, again, this is the Worlds just a few weeks ago, you were using a slither during the warm-ups. That is putting tip on the world stage.
You get away with nothing anymore. Like, I think I would have used the slither for many years and a lot of the athletes do, but because I was using it, it was... the next thing. But no, honestly, I recommend it to a friend.
For rolling out calves, that's the idea.
For anything, yeah, any knots, yeah.
It just has that kind of the edge to it, doesn't it?
It has the edges, yeah, that's what I would say.
Oh, top tip. But pity the fool who would challenge this woman to a race.
We saw some fun moments that you had online after while celebrating Tip won the Lee McCarthy.
Oh,
The person posting it says it was 6 a.m. What is happening in this video for anyone who hasn't seen it?
Yeah, it's as good as I guess that you can see is what I can see. I remember someone saying that, I bet I beat you in a race. And I thought, absolutely not. And I remember Mikey saying, you're absolutely not doing this. You're going to get injured. And then I, of course, was like, I absolutely am now that you told me no. So, yeah, thank God I won. That was the main thing.
That's you just running. The person who posts it says it's 6 o'clock in the morning, as I say, and that's you, international athlete, sprinting up a road in an estate in Tipperary. There are also claims that that's Boogie O'Mara attempting to race you.
Yeah, no, it was.
Former tip hurler.
At the time, I didn't know. My competitiveness just got the better of me. And, you know, no matter who was going to ask me to race that day, I was going to say yes.
There's no denying that it's you in the video because the speed takes off.
My strength and conditioning coach, Martina, had messaged me after and she was like, I'm not impressed that you're in your bare feet, but I'm impressed with your execution. So
it was your bare feet.
I took it as a win-win. Yeah.
I actually praised you. I love that.
Charlene Maudsley with Oliver. And yesterday, the deeply sad news of the death of Moncon McGann at the age of 55. The writer and documentary maker was a champion of the Irish language, and he brought a gentle and intelligent curiosity to his travels around the world. On Morning Ireland, Maggie Doyle spoke to Punchies Ní Gróine of TG Carr.
He's one of these people who helped us to really wonder at the things that are on our doorstep, the things that are all around us. He helped us, I think, to open up. I think he helped us to realise that the land, the bogs, his last series for T.G. Cahir on Holy Wells, you know, he had wonderful, wonderful line in there. He said, you know, these aren't sanctuaries of mythology, you know, these aren't something you go and visit and say a prayer and come away. There's actual genuine healing for the soul. And he compared it to an energy bank of a mobile phone, that there's actually energy trapped in these places. And it's up to us in a very kind of a humble way to tap that energy out and to complete the circuit, if you like. You know, he really believed that as a nation, we needed to complete this circuit, and the way we did that was delving into the past, and never ever in a highly academic or in a didactic way. It was always in a fun, in an exploratory, in a very honest, and he broke it down in a very simple way.
From Morning Ireland, a gifted broadcaster, he was a unique and free spirit.
I find it hard to believe the real world, and, you know, to believe in the real world, to believe in reality. But that existence beyond is just, I'm so often there, I'm so often in that. And so...
Why are you so attracted to it?
I just think there's people who are incarnated in the world, ready to be in this world and to focus on their body and to doing all the things. And I just wasn't one of those people. I was one of those people who's probably always had one foot in the other world. And so that's why I think that I always was connected with herbs and plants and trees and nature, because I think nature has one foot in the other world as well, you know?
So do you think or do you feel that there's another world?
I know there is, yeah. But not a world, just other realities, yeah, other realms.
The late Moncon McGann. And that is it from this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week. And we'll finish with some live music from Innie Kay, as heard on Arena. This is called Still a Day.